everyone. Welcome to the latest edition of the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. Back with Kaylee Bynes. I'm Ben Wilson. We are really, really excited for our June episode that we bring you today. And we're getting to catch up with one of our rising stars, so to speak, within the vasculitis researching world. And that is Dr. Sebastian Satoui. Kaylee, somebody who is we are very familiar with, who has participated in a number of our different media projects over the past year. And we are pretty excited to have him on today.
Definitely. I always have a soft spot for the people who say yes to our incessant emails. So, yeah. You know, glad to have him on.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about his background for those. And I should also preface that by saying we did have him on our Research Insights video, just a short snippet, about a 5-minute video. You can find that on the Vasculitis Foundation YouTube page. We recorded that with him last fall to get an idea of what he was working on. We'll go a little bit more in depth with him in this podcast, but give us an idea, Kaylee, what we can expect with some of his background.
Sure. So as you might expect, rheumatology, vasculitis focus, kind of that same great background that we're always excited to have. But I'm always interested in kind of the off the wall things that are part of people's backgrounds. So he also has his MS in clinical epidemiology and health services. So kind of more of a public health focus in addition to all of his experience with vasculitis. He actually started off in Peru and has his MD at the Universidad Peruana Cayetano Heredia. And so, you know, having both the Peruvian angle and also the American angle, and just having a lot of different backgrounds in various parts of science, but specifically in medical treatment, there's a lot to dig into with Dr. Satoui.
You did not have to do the pronunciation there, but very impressive.
Just had a show off.
On that, yeah, I would say so. Very much a show off. So yes, very well traveled is Dr. Satoui. We're going to get to him in just a moment. Also, one other note, we've been getting a number of voice memos, so to speak, on our Anchor page. I know you can listen anywhere, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you prefer to listen, but on our Anchor homepage online, we've been getting a number of messages from you as listeners. So we would encourage you to keep sending those in, but if you do that, just give us some contact information. We've had a number of those memos that have come in, and we have no idea how to get in touch with you or reach out. So some sort of contact info on your end would be really, really helpful. And we appreciate the interaction, and we would love to connect with as many of you as possible. So without further ado, let's get right into it. Dr. Sebastian Satoui joins us next on the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. All right, let's welcome in our latest guest, the June edition of our Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. Welcoming in Dr. Satoui now, and it is so great to have him on. I feel like he is somebody who barely sleeps at this point. It's all right, we check in with you, Dr. Satoui. It's like you're doing 8 million things at once. And the latest thing, you're getting ready for a big move. Tell us the latest in your journey here and where you will be heading off to an exciting new center where you'll be doing a lot of vasculitis work.
Yes. Well, thank you both for the invite. I think I usually follow up the podcast, and I'm very aware as well of the kind of East versus Midwest region of kind of fights, or keeping a track of kind of people who you interview. So I guess where I'm moving right now is a little bit in between the Midwest and the Northeast. So I'm finishing up my very long journey, as you mentioned. I'm finishing my rheumatology fellowship that has been a little bit extended thanks to my last 2 years of vasculitis training and fellowship that I have to, of course, thank the Vasculitis Foundation and the VCRC for the support. And I'm moving right now to Pittsburgh. So I'm joining the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, PIT, as an assistant professor, and going to be the co-director for the Vasculitis Center at Pitt, which is certainly very exciting. It's certainly kind of the goals of the VF BCRC fellowship as well, as to not only train new physicians, but enable kind of train them in to become kind of leaders in the field and be able to provide the care that patients with vasculitis need. And certainly that is my career goal as well. So I'm very excited about the move. Very excited about the institution that I'm joining. certainly saying goodbye to a lot of great people here in New York, but excited for kind of what this represents for both the care of kind of patients in the area where I'm moving. Certainly a little bit of change in the pace of my life as well, especially with the family and everything. And just a lot of the kind of continuing the work that I've already started here and continuing all my interactions with the vasculitis community, which certainly is exciting.
It's really amazing to hear about the Vasculitis Center at UPitt and just generally your plans for it and to co-lead it. Because I think when I was first diagnosed, there really weren't that many centers. You know, I was in DC and there are a couple places here, you know, and there are a couple places scattered around the US, but it's always really exciting for me to hear how certain centers are developing, especially as patients are, you know, becoming more and more familiar with this disease and being able to actually get care without driving for hours and hours to find doctors that are trained in this. This is really just great and exciting. So thank you for doing that work.
I think that's, it's certainly great. I think it's a little bit of the success story of the involvement of the VF and patients being so active and kind of like, you know, helping also young physicians or young clinician researchers in their training and kind of like encouraging this this path, which I think it's great. And at the same time, yes, it's the matter of not only getting a physician trained or being more aware, it's also kind of building of the structure that a lot of centers have already done. And I think Pitt has a great example of the multidisciplinary care that patients with vasculitis as in other rheumatologic diseases need. And that's what we need to strive for. And that's kind of the care that we need to provide for patients. So yes, I'm excited to be kind of continuing that path independently now, but as part of a great institution, but also kind of continuing the collaborations between all the different sites in the country and beyond, because I think that's a little bit part of the excitement and the really humbling part of being part of the vasculitis community.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think it's something Kaylee kind of touched on as well. I think you're now up to, is it 9 recognized centers by the VCRC is full of vasculitis centers, which is a pretty, you know, pretty incredible rise here recently. And it's outside of just the typical places you would expect, like the Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins, places like that. So it is kind of a testament to certainly how, as we talk all the time, just the growth of not only our community as a whole, but also the ability to treat patients as well as that, which is exciting. And I'm sure for you, it has to be just interesting. You touched on this as well, how we're coming up on the 2-year mark since you began your own fellowship through the VCRC and VF program. What sort of things have come along with your research that I know you were kind of ready and excited to start a couple of different projects a couple of years ago? Where do things stand now with all of that and kind of compared to your expectations when things all got started out for you here?
So I think, certainly the VF fellowship and the VCRC VF fellowship has given me a lot of opportunities with regards to like tailoring more my last 2 years of training into the specific care of patients with vasculitis, and has certainly supported me in kind of giving me more time in order to kind of devote myself to the projects that, you know, the pandemic certainly also kind of like, not, I would say to some degree kind of caused led to some restructuring, but at the same time opened a lot of other kind of opportunities as well that I think rheumatologists overall have been very active and certainly so have I with always a specific kind of vasculitis focus as well. A lot of some of the projects that the initial 2 projects that I started with, which I'm now kind of wrapping up and kind of going into the next steps with our one is one big focus that also has, I think, was in both my mind and my mentor's mind here, Dr. Spira, was something really fed and kind of reinforced by just our experience with patients is regarding the the importance or kind of exploring the importance or the impact of frailty in patients with vasculitis particularly, which we can certainly talk more on that. And we have kind of now an exciting study with the BPPRN trying to better describe the impact in patient of frailty in patients with living with vasculitis. That I know frailty has a strong word, is a strong word, and probably has a little bit of a negative connotation, but it's a very important process that I think englobes several kind of aspects of the life of people who live with chronic diseases such as vasculitis, and it's very important to actually find better ways to address. And for that, certainly, we need to describe it more. So that was one, and I can kind of go a little more into details. And the other work that I've been doing with collaboration with some of kind of our colleagues here at HSS and Weill Cornell was looking at a specific protein that's called mitochondrial DNA and trying to assess its use as a biomarker in patients with GPA. So those were the two initial projects that kind of I walked into the vasculitis fellowship with. And as I said, certainly things come up, ideas come up. I usually probably sometimes make the mistake of getting involved in too many things at the same time, but so far things have worked. And then of course a pandemic happened. And with the pandemic, I think rheumatologists globally were pushed into trying to find all the answers that both our patients and I had and we had, and therefore some other kind of ventures and collaborations happened as well, which have led to studies and trying to kind of be able to get that information that, you know, as we were talking initially, it seems it's been forever, but it hasn't been that long since we started since the pandemic started. And we certainly have come a long way with getting information for our patients, for better understanding of what is going on, what do we need to be concerned about. So that is this extra kind of focus of research that I've had during my last year or so of the vasculitis fellowship. So it's different lines of research all going in, fortunately, in the same kind of direction going forward, which is exciting and has certainly kept me busy as well. And that, of course, always in line with being involved in the care of patients with vasculitis, which is, again, the most important thing, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing is just that clinical kind of interaction, that interaction with patients, which is what motivates us all.
That's really impressive. Any one of those projects or patient care could be completely full-time. So the fact that you're doing all of this at once and juggling all of that is really just incredible. I did, before we get too far into the VASC Strong Frailty Study and the Global Rheumatology Alliance collaborations, I, as a GPA patient, my ears kind of pricked when you were talking about the mitochondrial protein as a biomarker. Can you talk a little bit more about that and kind of where that study is?
So we presented the results of that study in 2019 in the ACR. Like 2019, again, I've lost track of time. And right now working on the final manuscript, there's mitochondrial DNA, which is basically DNA from the mitochondria, gets released in several processes. And the idea is, as we all are in you know, rheumatology for the way more in vasculitis, is trying to find a some way in which we could anticipate disease manifestations, because we know that kind of patients with vasculitis, patients with GPA and any other form of vasculitis, relapse is a common feature, and it's something that of course concerns patients, is something that of course concerns us, and we're all in this kind of never ending search for something that could actually give us a little bit of information, allow us to act before time if needed. That is of course a very, you know, ideal scenario. But so we in collaboration with the laboratory of Dr. Choi in Weill Cornell, and this work was initially started by Dr. Spira and Dr. Lally here at HSS. We were trying to look using samples from very kind of an older study, so the WIGET study, so about some plasma samples from that study, trying to see if this protein actually correlated with some of the either flares or disease activity with patients. So this is very preliminary work. Why? Because the WIGET study was several years ago. And certainly we have, the samples are some limitation, but there were some important findings that might actually lead to probably bigger studies. Again, I think biomarker search is, even when you only talk about one specific one, is a very, very long path. And I think a lot of that the interest is there, will continue to be there. But this is just kind of the first initial steps into this, and we'll try to kind of continue forward with the center here. And this, of course, with involvement of the BCRC.
So we got you already. We figured Kaylee would get excited by multiple things you're talking about. And, the first thing you mentioned basically hit the jackpot. So well done by you right away. And it's kind of like, you lived up to the billing as when we introduce you. You are doing many things at the same time. I just wonder, from the, you kind of touched on this as well, like with the whole timeline aspect of this, and just thinking about how, and I know the whole goal of this is to identify some of these changes by using the biomarkers before you actually see symptoms in the whole relapse concept that you were talking about. Just from a logistical standpoint, and I'm sure you've thought about this, and it's part of the challenge of coming up with this long-term type study. How does that work, trying to identify things really before they even happen, and just knowing when to actually try and look at these different markers and test patients and get all of those sorts of things lined up?
And that's a difficult thing, at least the way I personally see it regarding biomarker discovery, is that there needs to be several phases, in order to actually validate, feel that something is strong enough before you actually act upon it. Because when we're talking about acting, like if you are concerned about a flare, of course, that will imply, okay, I need to act, cool this down before it becomes a big issue. And that implies medications. And and as we all know, and certainly patients know way more kind of based on their experiences, that medications sometimes carry some risks or not. So I think that's the challenging part when you talk about biomarker discovery, because it's not only actually identifying something that can correlate with disease activity, can correlate with a flare or not, but it's also having the certainty that will lead to that, and giving you the confidence enough, kind of, because this is also risk and benefit. If this can correlate or not, is this going to be certain enough for you to actually go ahead with medication changes or not? So I'm certainly, there are people who are way, way more deep into this field than I am, for sure. But from my view, that's kind of the challenging part of this. I think biomarker discovery is kind of like the holy grail to some degree in some of the aspects of our diseases, but I think it implies so many things, and that's probably why we're still kind of chasing that and kind of looking for that holy grail. But it's still, there's several things that need to happen before actually reaching that. So I don't know if that necessarily answers the question, but I think it's quite complex for sure.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm glad somebody as smart as you is trying to tackle that, because I can see how that would get very complicated and difficult.
Definitely. And it also, from a patient perspective, it really is the holy grail in my mind, just mentally to be able to say, I can get a fairly definitive test with a biomarker of disease activity, as opposed to looking at my ANCA or my creatinine levels or anything else to actually help me manage disease, and not just, me being a little bit paranoid saying, oh, there was an ache in my joint. Is that just because I played soccer yesterday, or is it because, something's wrong? And like you said, it really does have an impact on your ability to change or stop medication. So even when I stopped rituximab about 2 years ago now, it's really a guess. I hadn't flared, so we hope it's okay. But there's nothing to say, okay, definitively, this is probably a good time to stop. It's really a gut check almost. And so having a biomarker, would be huge. So thank you for working towards that.
At the same time, I think, as all patients know and all physicians know, that is just one piece of the puzzle. And I think I would love to say that at some point we're going to reach to a blood test that will just tell us everything that we need. But we know our patients and their diseases are far more complex than that. So I think it's always going to be a combination of what we still do nowadays. We, of course, need to aim and kind of for something that is more sensitive and more specific to what we're looking for, but we still need to keep listening to our patients. I think patient communication, it's important, it's key. And sometimes patients and their bodies tell us what lab tests are not. So again, it is important. We need to keep trying for it. There's people who are like way more dedicated in the trench of the lab, kind of trying to every single day trying to figure this out. But I think it's certainly one important piece of a very difficult puzzle that includes several factors and that, you know, are going to be driven a lot by just listening to the patient, communication with the patient, and kind of looking at all these factors at the same time.
And that whole idea too, just of the patient communication, I know it as you mentioned, it applies to this particularly, but also something I'm sure this applies as well to the other sort of topic of research that you discussed with the frailty study and all that. And sort of like what Kaylee was saying, I know for us as patients, there's always those certain things that I know we all kind of agree that all happened to us, but we don't really know how to quantify it. I would say like fatigue is a big one of those. It's like, how do you really quantify fatigue specifically in a vasculitis patient? How did you try and quantify then in your studies with something like frailty, which is a very similar thing? And I know that more proportionally impacts people in that older 50 and up range, but how did you guys try to go about it in that particular study?
So frailty is a very interesting concept that, as you described, it initially got, initially was described and defined more in the geriatric population, you know, and this is probably something that we all think of, and we completely associate with age. We also always kind of think of this as certainly it has a negative label. It sounds a little bit more it's a label that probably none of us want, but kind of in the more in the medicine field, it's just a definition to a process that mostly refers to this kind of physiological decline that and basically just like losing our physiological reserves and our ability to bounce back from stressors. So this is again something that is actually thought to be associated to aging, but it's not necessarily it's not a process that strictly happens with aging, but can be associated to other kind of conditions as well. So there are multiple factors that can kind of like, you know, wipe out or decrease our reserves. Living with a chronic condition is certainly one of them. And this is it started in geriatrics, but it has certainly made its way to other fields, for example, cardiology, even surgical fields as well. And it's something that it's becomes more important. And like you were mentioning, and I mentioned before, it's something, it also englobes different aspects of it. So this is not just what your disease is doing. So if your disease flares or not, this is also how it is impacting your life. If there's fatigue associated to it, if you're actually feeling kind of having difficulty in your daily activities to some degree, and there are multiple actually ways to measure it as well, definitions based on kind of our tools in the literature to do this. Interestingly, it's starting to make its way into rheumatology overall as a specialty. One, because our patients live with chronic conditions, and there are several aspects of patients' life that we need to better understand. Two, and one thing that is interesting is that a lot of frailty, as long as other processes of kind of aging, have been actually associated with chronic levels of inflammation or subclinical inflammation. And a lot of kind of inflammatory markers that we usually think of, such as like, for example, IL-6, so interleukin-6, that we have tocilizumab that we use for some of our patients with GCA. So there is not only a kind of some aspects of the clinical aspects, but there's also some kind of associations that have been done with to the more molecular level that are interesting, that make it kind of a to some degree reinforce what we see in some of our patients' experience within the path of their disease. And that's why I think it made sense to some to us here, even discussing it with patients who our first study here was actually done in PMR patients as well, which is, as most vasculitis patients are aware, kind of a sister disease given its association with GCA. And even though sometimes it took a while for patients to kind of go past the actual word itself, it makes sense. It rang a bell in different aspects of their life and englobed a lot of their kind of the concerns that they felt or experienced or thought of, but couldn't really necessarily like put under an umbrella or tie up. So the VASC Strong study is trying to better describe how important or how common frailty is, because we want to be able to not only kind of describe what is the problem and how common is the problem, but actually find ways in which we can actually prevent and act on it. Of course, this is further down the road. We need to first describe the problem in order to know what's the best way to act upon it. But we need to describe it, see who experiences more. This hasn't really been actually described that much in patients with vasculitis, except for like a very couple, like two studies, if it rings a bell. And try to kind of better, again, find a way and we can actually not only act upon it, because this is not a label that is like static, it's a dynamic process, but also try to prevent it. Because we know there's kind of the path with living with a chronic disease, the path is a journey. So if we can actually prevent things before happening, that's certainly better. And this is kind of the initial attempts into doing that. And we're certainly excited about BPPRN hosting this study. We're using a standardized tool for it as well, which is a very simple questionnaire, and just trying to hear from patients what they feel about it, what they think helped or didn't help, and kind of start from there.
I always laugh when I tell the story about my diagnosis, because when I was going to all these different doctors trying to figure out what was wrong with me, one of the doctors that I had visited told me, "Oh, you're just senescing." At the ripe old age of 23. And I was like, I don't think that's correct. So it's interesting to see a whole study framed on frailty associated with chronic disease. And I know you said you're still really describing the population, but do you have any sense so far about what kind of interventions might be available to prevent frailty? Is it more behavioral? Is it medication-based? Is it a combination?
So, you know, Like I said, one, a lot of this, certainly what frailty in vasculitis is relevant because it's a chronic disease, so it's certainly important. Two, there are aspects of particularly thing with patients with, you know, given the patients who have PMR, GCA, it even rings more of a bell of why are patients with kind of in this age group having this condition that has this markers that might be or not be associated to frailty. With regards to measures, I think the first thing is, one is physical activity, which I think as physicians, and this is a little bit of a mea culpa, because we don't actually talk about enough, and we probably don't know. We need to find better ways in which we need to guide our patients through. It's certainly difficult. There are moments that are more challenging than others, but physical activity has certainly proved not only to improve kind of frailty itself, so move you out of frailty ideally, but actually to prevent it itself. And this is, you know, if you talk about kind of the concept of successful aging, which is certainly one of my interests as well, completely reinforced by patients, because I think patients always ask me, like, how is this going to impact my life from now on? I think that is the one thing that we constantly know, whether this is in just people who don't live with a rheumatic disease, people who live with other chronic conditions, or people who live with rheumatic diseases, physical intervention has an impact in multiple levels. So that's one. With regards to medications, there really not hasn't been anything yet seen. I think there's a lot of actually some studies using some medications. I'm not going to get into like mentioning them because it's very preliminary and like controls like RCTs that are happening. But I think it would be interesting actually to see with regards to our kind of medications, specifically given the link that there is between this association between inflammation and frailty and other age-related outcomes. There is really nothing interventional-wise yet to actually know, but I think, of course, when we talk about this, the first thing that comes to the mind of every patient and every physician is we need to bring down glucocorticoids and steroids, prednisone use, which certainly I think that is the goal. That's where we are all moving towards to. I think this might be another reason too, but there's that relationship, there's certainly more to elucidate and hopefully we can get a better idea from this study and what comes after that.
That's certainly where I think the VPPRN will definitely help with that is, you know, kind of how you mentioned that's the next step, I guess, with this, try to collect the patient data. And I just think back to the first episode we did this year where we had Kaylin Young, the director of the VPPRN, on and sort of talking about some of the overall challenges of trying to make the data they get effective for people like you and how can they, you know, get the patient responses to be more specific and not so just generic about the whole, you know, how are you feeling on a scale of 1 to 10 metrics. So just from the very early preliminary stuff you're seeing so far, do you feel, you kind of feel like that is a really good use of getting specific, especially for something like this, where you say you're not, it's so early in the process, you can't really know a for sure, you know, way of impact and, you know, kind of cause and effect sort of deal.
Well, I think the BPPRN is a fantastic platform for research because when you're talking about rare conditions like vasculitis, I think having all this data collected periodically, patients who are actively involved and kind of providing the information, you know, I don't think of any better example of patients being involved and kind of like really pushing research going forward. For us, I think it's you know, it's there's certain, of course, we're describing again. So there's with regards to talking about like strong associations and everything. This is an initial step, but again, it's an initial and important step with good information that will allow us not only to kind of query this at one point, but we actually have a plan for a follow up of this as well, and actually seeing how what patients told us at the beginning. And how kind of with regards to the measures of frailty and so actually correlated with what happened to them in the following year, which is important because we know that it can impact clinical outcome, quality of life, and that's exactly what we want to be able to understand better. So I think it's great. I'm very excited from again the support from the BPPRN and the VCRC and the VF for this study. And I think it's going to be, it's going to give us very important information for sure.
So speaking of patient input and how you incorporate that in your research, I know you're currently working on the Global Rheumatology Alliance COVID study, as well as other studies. Was the COVID study out of concern that patients are bringing up about their own treatment plans? Was it, you know, something that really came from rheumatologists saying we need to know and get ahead of this? Or how did that come about?
So the GRA is another great example of kind of how amazing the rheumatology community is, to be honest. And when I say rheumatology community, I talk about physicians, patients, any other people involved, clinician researchers or just researchers, social workers in rheumatology, anyone who is involved in the rheumatology world, because literally this is what the GRA is. It's actually this global organization, people from all over the world who have actually, back in, when was this, March of last year, actually one of your previews in kind of one of the, Dr. Calabrese, who I think was recently in the last episode in the podcast, he actually kind of sent a tweet out saying, hey, the IBD clinicians, so the people who are researchers in inflammatory bowel disease are doing this registry. Why is this not happening? And in a matter of like a week, our whole registry was set with a whole patient arm in both, like representative in both men as well. Another survey was set up, and that I think it has been just wonderful because it's allowed, again, with certain limitations of the data, but collecting data and kind of guiding, giving valuable data very early on since the pandemic and allowing both patient representatives, physicians being involved in different aspects of either studies or kind of patient advocacy. We all kind of know of all these issues with hydroxychloroquine very early on in the pandemic, that is certainly a very important medication for a lot of patients with rheumatic diseases, particularly lupus patients. And there's, and I think there's been just involvement from different people from different backgrounds in all these steps, which has been great. The push for this, the interest for this was our patients were anxious. And as I acknowledged, all my patients I think throughout the whole pandemic, so were we, because we didn't have answers for our patients. It was a new disease, a new virus. We were all kind of concerned of what this could represent. Rheumatologists and patients were concerned of what could happen with them, because we know infection and immunosuppressive medications are not a good combination. So this just led to all this different analysis going on that have certainly, again, given great information. And it's a bunch of different initiatives that have, I think, been great. The same way as there was registry for cases to try to better understand. And this is kind of the analysis that we're doing, looking into what factors kind of were associated with worse outcomes of COVID-19 infection in patients with vasculitis. There was also whole survey trying to look into the impact. And this was like patients answering the questions, not physicians providing information, but patients answering how the pandemic had impacted them. Now there is a new survey trying to look into patients' attitudes, concerns, and experiences with the vaccine as well, because the goal is to provide information, and it's for that information to go back as quickly as possible to providers, to rheumatologists, to ENT doctors, whoever is involved in the care of patients with rheumatologic conditions, rheumatologic diseases, and most importantly to patients, because this is a process that we've all walked together. This is information that we all keep just taking in, because it's all brand new. So it has been, I think, a great experience. I haven't felt as connected with the rheumatology community as I was quarantined from my house late April. And I think it just speaks wonderfully what I already knew about the vasculitis community, and the same for the rheumatology community. It's a very active and collaborative group of people everywhere.
I'm always impressed by how much the medical professionals really take patients into account and our opinions and our thoughts into account. I've worked at health departments and research organizations, and a lot of times there are those very strong silos between patients and anyone who's providing their care. Why do you think that vasculitis in particular, and I know the rheumatological community as a whole, but specifically for vasculitis, do you think it's because it's so rare that patients are able to be heard? Or I guess how did it come about that patients are able to really have their finger in all these pies?
Well, one, because there are organizations like the VF that kind of give a voice to patients. Two is, I think, I'm not that old, but I think the model of care is fortunately changing. And this is a kind of a team effort. This is not, I don't know if, again, this is part of my practice or the community they live in, but I think that's what I see in with kind of people in other fields. I think that's overall changing with medicine, which I think is great. It is probably, is it kind of somehow fueled or related to rare diseases? I think it's probably because it's a chronic disease as well, and patients, and there is, I think, as rheumatology, because we're a younger specialty, we acknowledge that there's so much to learn, and who do better to have as a learning partner than our patients who actually kind of have all this information and experiences that they live with. And I think, again, similar to what a lot of what is kind of my interest came into, how do inflammatory conditions impact aging? This is a question that I just heard a million times from patients. How is this condition going to affect my next year? So this is not only of like, okay, I'm concerned about what the diagnosis and all the stuff that you're telling me about, but how is this going to impact my life around? And there's so many questions that are so valuable. And I think, again, it's a matter of partnership. And I think we do have that, and we appreciate that a lot. And that's kind of certainly what I enjoy about the field. Absolutely. And the connections and the relationships that we have with our patients.
I mean, even just thinking back to, it certainly does. Even just thinking back to like last summer when we were, speaking with, I remember we had Dr. Dua, Dr. Putnam, a number of others that are kind of in that, younger physician researcher type group. And it was all kind of, I remember thinking sort of the same thing from what they were saying, and how it was just, it was such a guided team effort that they just sort of felt like it's kind of part of your, it's in your guys' DNA almost. So, and speaking of Dr. Putnam, you both come on our podcast right as you're about to move and start a new venture. So I guess we have some sort of, we have some weird things in common with getting guests on that are about to start new and exciting opportunities. But we certainly appreciate you taking the time, Dr. Satui. It's awesome to kind of see where things have gone from the last time you and I spoke in our patient researcher spotlight video back last fall in New York City, and where things are going now. So I know we're certainly excited to see where things go for you guys. And obviously a lot of this research is, as always, is ongoing and kind of just getting going. So we're looking forward to seeing how that all shapes up, and wish you the best of luck in your move and getting settled in Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much. Yes. That's happening so soon. I think I'm not as concerned as I should be, but with everything that kind of comes with the move. But yes, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I think I'm glad to be part of a group of kind of, I guess, upcoming young investigators who are like very devoted to the vasculitis community. Certainly Mike Putman and Joyce have organized a little bit, so we meet every once in a while, so which is great. It's a very receptive community, and certainly happy to be part of. Glad to talk with you again, Ben and Kaylee, and just look forward to any other kind of opportunities to do so.
Thanks again to Dr. Satui for joining us. So cool to hear about Kaylee, all of his different projects going on right now, and always crazy to be in New York during the midst of a pandemic, and now moving on to, I guess, greater pastures with his new ventures in similar part of the Northeast. But exciting to hear about all those things for sure.
Definitely. And like all of our guests, he's definitely one to watch. I'm very excited to see what happens at the UPitt Medical Center, Vasculitis Center. I think it's just great to have, as we said on the podcast, more centers and more doctors who are trained in vasculitis and who know what sort of treatments and follow-up patients like us need. So I'm really excited to see what happens next.
Certainly. I think that is a good last word for this podcast. As always, we want to thank our presenting sponsors in Genentech and GSK. As we say so long for Kaylee Bynes, I'm Ben Wilson. We will catch you next time. We'll have another episode coming up in early July. Look out for that wherever you get your podcasts, here through the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast.